Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel.
So, question for you, the listener, the viewer. Wouldn't you love to have a confidential chat with a copywriter working at the highest levels of our business? Well, we can't provide the confidential part. I mean, this is a podcast after all, not a signal chat. But today's guest, Kane Smith, is on the front lines of some of the biggest businesses using direct response. So we can provide you with the copywriter working at the highest levels of our business part. Kane's clients include real estate giant Grant Cardone, financial publishing giant Agora Financial, fitness and nutrition giant VShred, as just three examples. His experience spans info products and e-com, low ticket and high ticket, long form and short form funnels. And we got him to come on to tell us what he's noticing at the cutting edge, because his observations, when put into action, can mean more money in your pocket. But I wouldn't think of asking Kane a thing until I first reminded you that copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear on this podcast, and most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims, and or if you're writing copy for offers in highly regulated industries like health, finance, and business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. So let's get started. Kane, welcome, and glad you're here.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on, David.
Sure. So let's start with this. Since you've got your finger on the pulse of direct response copy and marketing at a pretty high level these days, what would you say is the one big change in copywriting most people aren't even aware of yet?
I would say, I think, that there's been a shift probably in the past year or so. And if I judge, you know, when I'm scrolling social media feeds and judging at posts I see and comments from other copywriters, I think a lot of them aren't aware that this shift has taken place. And it's basically the idea that the niche copywriter, so the copywriter with the niche specialism, perhaps the copywriter who specializes in emails or says, I write sales letters. There's less of a demand because the industry is going through a consolidation period. And I think this is largely due to AI and the way it's democratized copywriting to the small business owner who can get AI to write his own stuff, or the marketing team who are able to carry out copywriting tasks quite quickly now without needing to hire a writer. The industry's consolidated, and now the copywriters who are winning are generalists. They're people who can control the funnel from start to finish, and there just seems to be less utility now for these niche specialists. Certainly, industry specialism is desired, but specializing in one particular type of copy now isn't as lucrative or as in demand as it once was.
Wow, that's great. I haven't heard that before. As I think about it, as I review my own observations and past experiences, I think you're right. And I think, you know, people need to pay attention to that. So let's talk about you for a second. How did you get started in copywriting, and how did you end up where you are now?
Oh, so I got started in copywriting quite late, David. I think it was late. Anyway, I was in my early 30s when I wrote my first piece of copy. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a sales or marketing background. I was working in the security industry, you know, physical, blue-collar security. And from that point on, I went through a few middle management positions. I was always in service delivery, never sales and marketing. But I'd always enjoyed writing. It had been, you know, my strength at school. I used to write fiction for fun on the side. And I always wanted to write for a living in some way. So this was back in 2018. I started writing for content mills, just a few articles. I remember getting paid $25 for the very first article I wrote. And from that point on, I moved into SaaS. I thought that business looked like it was booming. The copy was quite short. I felt it was relatively easy to write. But it was only around 2020 when I did a hard pivot into direct response copy. I got bit by the bug at that time, and I saw that's where all the opportunity was in writing direct response copy, specifically long form copy.
Okay. Wow. Interesting background. I don't know anyone else. So when you say physical security, at the lowest level, you were like a security guard?
Yep. What we call here in the UK, a shirt filler. My job was just to kind of stand there, let people in a venue, wish them good night. It was, you know, it paid terrible. I was miserable. It was not what I wanted to do.
Oh, like security at an event, like at a concert or a nightclub?
Yeah. I worked in a department store for years, catching shoplifters. I worked on nightclub venues, events, stuff like that. Yeah, I hated it. But I was in that industry for years as well, for a long time.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're happier in the new one that you're in now. Let's talk about e-commerce, because that is a big niche. We haven't talked about it much on the show. What have you noticed about e-commerce, and how does this present opportunities for direct response copywriters?
Huge opportunity in e-com. And I think what's happening is, David, the line between e-com and direct response is getting blurry now. I think there's huge opportunity. What's happening in that industry is you have a lot of skilled media buyers, guys who are very good at running ads. Some of them may have been drop shippers in a former life. And they're becoming increasingly serious about their businesses now. There's so many of them, and it's getting so competitive as well. They're realizing that to stand out, they need to win on messaging, because of a lot of e-com products tend to be quite commoditized. Ad costs are rising, so there's not much profit to squeak out there on the front end. So they're kind of looking to direct response marketing for strategies that they can apply to e-com businesses. They're basically discovering stuff that we've known about for years, you know, direct response marketers have known about for decades. Some of the strategies and principles we use in direct response are still relatively new to e-com. They've only been kind of crossing over into our world for a couple of years now, a few years. So I think there is opportunity there for copywriters to kind of make that transition and bridge that gap between direct response and e-com. There's a massive talent gap between what I would call, you know, like Shopify copy versus, you know, the real performance-driven copy we use in direct response.
Yeah, so some of these basic concepts, I'm assuming, are things like average order value, lifetime value of the customer, recency, primacy, monetary, things like that?
Absolutely, yeah. They've been playing, e-com businesses have been playing mainly an acquisition game for many, many years. And as the customer acquisition costs have risen, and the margins are getting slimmer and slimmer, as you said, they're looking for copywriters, direct response marketers, who can increase AOVs in the front end funnel. And then there's a load of kind of lifetime value extending back end monetization stuff, where they're relatively inexperienced, and direct response copywriters can come in and provide a lot of value to these businesses by implementing a lot of the strategies we use in our day jobs, so to speak.
Yeah, so that sounds like it's also an opportunity for copywriters who have been squeezed out of their niche by AI and other trends. Okay, VSLs. People think, you know, VSL is like a long TV show, half an hour. You've noticed something different, right? What have you noticed what's going on with VSLs these days?
Two things. Well, mainly one is that long-form VSLs aren't performing the way they once were. And to be clear, that they're still performing. There are long-form VSLs that are still working. And I still believe that nothing can scale an offer better than an effective long-form VSL. It's just that it's got harder to do now, and shorter-form VSLs winning, whether they're playing in the feed, you know, on Meta or in YouTube, or whether we're taking people away from the feed and sending them to a different page. VSLs are getting shorter. I have some theories on why that's the case. Mainly, one is that there's been this argument for a while, David, between people who say, oh, attention spans are getting shorter, right? We're seeing TikTok, YouTube Shorts, these really short videos. People struggle to pay attention to stuff the way they used to. And then the other school of thought is attention spans are not getting shorter. People can watch a lot, listen to a long form podcast. They can binge watch their favorite television series on Netflix for hours on end. So it's not an attention span problem. It's a quality problem. I believe the truth lies in the middle, where never before have we had so much optionality and choice. If we think of focus as being the elimination of distraction, we've never been so distracted with social media apps, with the options available to us online. So it's much harder to hold someone's attention now just because we have so much choice. And this is why short form VSLs are winning. They're not as demanding on the executor, really, to hold someone's attention span for that long. You know, you can do it in 5 or 10 minutes now, as opposed to having to hold someone's attention for 30 to 40 minutes. It's much harder to do.
I think that one of the things that we're having to adjust with is also the type of market. In 2010, a BizOp VSL, you could have held somebody's attention for 45 minutes. Now that person, attention span or not, they've probably seen 1,000 VSLs already. They're probably value their time a lot more versus if your market is maybe less sophisticated or less bombarded with marketing. They say somebody who's dealing with diabetes and wants to know the secret bamboo trick to curing their diabetes. They haven't been through 15 VSLs in the last year. They might sit through the 45-minute one. So I think that it's not just attention span. I think it's also who are you trying to get to watch and what's their sophistication level when it comes to your type of marketing.
I would agree. And I would also say dopamine hits have a lot to do with it. I mean, if you watch a movie, Hollywood studio movie from, you know, 30 years ago, there's a much longer span of time between really exciting, heart-wrenching moments or, you know, nail-biting moments than today. I mean, you watch a movie on Netflix and there's action every minute or two. There's something going on around every corner. You're sitting on the edge of your seat waiting for the next shoe to drop. And so I think, you know, we've been trained by TikTok videos to expect dopamine hits quickly. And so when you said quality, I totally agreed. I think part of quality for a viewer these days is not necessarily the intellectual artistic nature of the VSL, but just the fact that it gets you a jolt in some sort. Do you think that's true?
I agree with both of your points, absolutely. And just to kind of add to those, first of all, if we think of the long form VSL experience, the way it's say played out over the past decade, it's not the most native experience. You know, to take someone from the feed and put them on a page where with a video that fills the screen, there's no option to kind of speed the video up or go back. There's a lot of the time there isn't even a progress bar at the bottom of the video, and we kind of pen people onto that page. It's never been a very kind of user-friendly experience. And now, like you say, that people are being conditioned to have a different experience in the feed. And yes, the content as well, these regular dopamine hits, it's forced us to change certainly kind of the hooks and the leads of VSLs now with how we first stop the scroll and how we lead people into the sales message. As an example, you see like the ones that do it very well, that VSLs that are still winning in long form, for example, the Golden Hippo, Gundry ones, you know, you look at that format, it's very useful advertising where they might be taking you through kind of 5 foods to avoid or 5 things not to do. And it feels very native to the platform. It feels almost like organic content at the start rather than these more traditional VSL leads, which, like Nathan says, sophistication levels have risen now to the point where people's antenna are up and they know that a sales pitch is coming pretty early with those.
Yeah, so one way to frame it might be taking more of an advertorial approach to the scripting of a VSL, yeah?
Agree. And on the subject of advertorials, they are working as well as ever. With a lot of the clients that I work with now, we're heavily focused on advertorials. That this idea of people clicking through, and there's some kind of there's a story that has almost like a tabloid news quality to it. Like those that type of copy is still very appealing, and they're still working very well, both from native traffic and Meta as well.
Okay, that sounds good. Besides advertorials, what are some other modern sales formats that are working better than the old school long form VSLs?
Okay, so we've covered short form VSLs, but quizzes are working very well. I actually do a lot of work on quiz funnels these days, and I think that quiz funnels work. They can be almost like a segmentation tool if you're gathering the data, but mainly it's a disguised sales letter in a way. It's like a sideways sales letter. It delivers a very personalized experience. So whereas, say, like the old text sales letter felt like a really personal one-to-one conversation, with the quiz funnel, we can isolate people's attention and distract them, and it feels like a very personalized experience where the customer's very engaged in that sales process. There was a word for it, wasn't there, David? What Gary Halbert used to call was it a grabber? Being able to kind of, if you got a piece of mail and there was something physical in there.
Yeah, if you're selling land, maybe you would have a bag of dirt at the top of the letter, and they called a grabber, right?
That's right, yeah. It's something that would actually get you to engage, like in that case, physically engage with the materials to kind of isolate your attention. Quizzes do that. They force the user to actively engage with the marketing message. So quiz funnels are very effective.
Let me ask you about quizzes, if I could interrupt you. Sorry. Are you talking about a straight line, or are you talking about a quiz that will morph or adapt depending on what answers that people give?
Well, yeah, you're right. There are two types. There's the more dynamic ones, which might give people, it becomes like a choose your own adventure thing where you can deliver a different offer depending on the answers to the quiz. Now, these do tend to be quite easy to build in the sense that you could have three or four different outcomes depending on who the avatar is, and you might deliver three or four reports or send them to three or four short VSLs that maybe have a different lead or a different hook. But the majority of the quizzes I work on, like, they tend to have a similar outcome. You're basically kind of putting the customer through the same experience, and the questions that you're asking are just kind of building up their desire. You're getting them to identify with the problem, but essentially kind of diagnose their own symptoms, and the solution always tends to be the same. It's your offer.
Okay, that's very cool. What are some simple testing strategies copywriters, and I mean, testing used to be so complicated, and it still can be, and there are some very good sophisticated CRO techniques, but what are some simple techniques for testing that copywriters and marketers are using successfully these days?
So I think more hooks are being tested than ever before. Certainly from when I got involved, volume of hooks is really important. Again, we're talking about a really crowded marketplace, audiences who are more sophisticated than ever. So for instance, if I'm writing ad scripts, at a bare minimum, I'm writing 10 different hooks that I can stick on top of the script. I typically write 3 to 5 different CTAs as well. And then you can kind of modularize your copy by putting all these different things in different combinations. So sheer volume and breaking down your copy into modular testing elements, I think that's really important these days. Another one, which is, I suppose it's more of a broader strategy than a tactic, but it's to communicate very closely with media buyers and CROs, which in my experience, not a lot of copywriters do, and they tend to kind of operate in a silo. Whereas if you can kind of tag team with a media buyer, because they're seeing more data than you are, you know, it's their day job, they're seeing it all day long. And if you can kind of pair up with them and get them to read the data with you, and you can brainstorm ideas together and test almost as like this kind of specialist crack team in a duo. I did that for 2 years for one client where we were just constantly optimizing an offer by working together in a team of two that way. That can be very effective.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great idea. Of course, that does maybe require a little bit of surrendering of the ego of the copywriter who thinks they have all this talent and knowledge, and in fact is No, the marketplace has all the talent and the knowledge, and this other person's going to help you understand what it is, right?
It also includes a little bit of sacrificing of the ego of the media buyer, because a lot of times media buyers don't want to work that closely with the copywriter. They want to take the credit or place the blame, and they don't want to be sharing the responsibilities.
I'm lucky in the sense I've had some positive experiences with media buyers where it's a mutually beneficial relationship. You know, if they're getting paid based on ad spend, for instance, and if they can kind of, if you can shorten that feedback loop together by sharing the data and kind of riffing on the angles together, and you can get this working faster with improved communication, you as the copywriter benefit, the media buyer tends to benefit if their compensation is linked to ad spend. So I've had positive experiences with it. I also appreciate, though, that some of your listeners, they may not be working on projects ongoing with a media buyer or a CRO. It may be more of a one and done thing. But to be honest, that's the kind of stuff I discourage anyway. And it's the kind of stuff that clients are starting to value less and less. The clients, they want you to stick around. They want you to get an offer working rather than just hand over a Google Doc and then run away.
Yeah, okay, that's good. Well, last question, and take as long as you want with this. Where do you see direct response copywriting heading in 2025?
I mean, the bar is going up for sure, and I think we all know the reason why. AI is, it's surprising even me, and I was a fan of it when ChatGPT first came out in 2022. I saw the potential, and I thought, this is pretty cool. It is accelerated at a rate I didn't expect, and I'm very
or anybody else. I mean, no one thought.
There are a few exceptions. I don't know if you've ever spoken to the copywriter Sam Woods or heard of him. I know he was.
I have. I'd like to get in touch. If you know him, maybe you could introduce us. That would be very cool.
Gladly. Yeah, I know him. Sam was kind of saw this coming. He was playing with AI tools before ChatGPT. But granted, you know, like that's an exception. Most of us couldn't have expected this kind of development. So where I see AI copywriting going in 2025 is I think AI is going to get so sophisticated. We are turning. I've looked through history because I love history. Okay, I read a lot of history books. And one of the things, when the printing press first came out, I feel like this is what we can compare it to. When the printing press came out, it displaced a lot of the monk scribes who up to that point had been valued for their expertise to write and transcribe. And then the printing press came along and it transferred that information far better than they ever could. And the story that's not often told is what happened to those scribes in the years following that. Many of them were like, you know, their livelihood was gone, that they were no longer valued. The best and the most skilled ones who weren't merely transcribing the words, but they had genuine expertise and knowledge and wisdom, they were sought out at the monasteries in, I suppose, what we'd call like consulting engagements. You know, people still really valued the information these guys had. And I see as we go into 2025, I can see copywriters more and more being off the tools, so to speak, in the sense that I think AI and AI agents are going to do a lot of the fingers on keyboard writing for us. And we are going to have to do more and more strategy, which at the heart of it, I know that's what copywriting always has been. It's been strategic thinking. And now the labor component, I think, is going to get stripped out. And we are really going to get judged on the quality of our ideas more so than ever before. So if you consider yourself a strategy person and an ideas person, I think you're going to thrive, because there are a lot of people who are not good at that. And they're the people who are going to fall away and maybe drop out of the race. Unfortunately, that's been happening a lot already with writers who haven't been able to kind of stick around and keep a footing in the industry since AI has developed at the rate it has. So I know that sounds a bit bleak. I suppose it depends which way you're looking at it. Personally, I think it's a good thing, and it's just going to lead to more and more quality output from the copywriters who embrace the changes.
I feel like I've never heard it put quite so eloquently. I love your analogy and the amount of thought you've put into it. I mean, in terms of an action step, I think everyone listening should keep listening to Copywriters Podcast, because we strive to bring in experts and great thinkers like you, thought leaders like you. And secondly, strive to become a consulting scribe. Yeah, that's what I think.
I'm just going to add to that.
Nathan can't hear you. Oh.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to add to that. When AI first came on, and back ChatGPT 3, I started playing with it, and I saw where it was going. I was also following Sam Woods. He's a wealth of information on this stuff. I was a little bit intimidated. I was like, where is this going to go? But diving into it, learning how to use it better than 90% of the solutions out there, and the sheer amount of work that I can get done now and then just go back through and do the tweaking, do the adjusting, do the editing, and knowing how to guide it. It's not to the point yet where you can just say, hey, I'm selling some sneakers, will you write me a sales page? And it's not at that point yet. And I'm not sure that it ever will get to the point where it can just completely replace an A-list copywriter that knows how to use it. My two cents on it is, Nathan's a great copywriter. AI is a decent copywriter, but Nathan plus AI is top tier. And so that's kind of where I think that the people that want to stick around, the people that want to be those monks that you were talking about that didn't get wiped out, them copywriter plus AI is better than copywriter and better than AI.
Yeah.
Agreed. Agreed. And one more point on that, if you don't mind. Sure. One of the things I found as well with this is, like, if you love to write, and most copywriters, you know, there are some marketers who kind of learn copywriting as a necessary skill and they aren't necessarily in love with the writing process. Many copywriters, we started as writers first and learn sales and marketing, and we love writing. And I just think if you use AI in your process, it frees up so much more time to work on projects that maybe aren't sales copy. And if you're in love with the writing process and you're in love with physically putting your fingers on the keyboard and kind of being almost one with it, it's just going to free up more time for us to write essays, articles, fiction in your spare time, while you can earn your income without having to spend as many hours on the keyboard writing the stuff that's in your head. So I think it can be a wonderful time saver in our livelihoods and free up a lot more time for us to pursue passion projects where we can write, you know, more fun stuff on the side.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Okay, so a ton of good information in today's episode. Kane, you reached out to us on LinkedIn. I think that's where you're most active. If people want to connect with you, how can they find you on LinkedIn?
I'm on LinkedIn. If you just search for Kane Smith on there, I'm probably the only guy on there with that name. My name is spelled C-A-I-N Smith, or feel free to reach out to me by email. It's kane@kanesmith.com.
All right. We will make sure to have links in the show notes. So if you want an easy way to find Kane, head on over to copywriterspodcast.com. Check the show notes there, and we'll make it super easy for you. And again, man, thanks for coming on. Thanks for sharing all with our audience. We really appreciate you. And until next time, we will catch you later.
Catch you later.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Before we go, a quick question. Would you like to have me as a guest on your podcast? Let me give you an easy way to contact me about that. We've put up a form on garfinkelmedia.com, and it won't take much more than a minute to fill it out. So if you'd like to have me on your show, just go to garfinkelmedia.com and fill out the form. That's garfinkelmedia.com. Thanks, and see you next time on the Copywriters Podcast.